So, many do feel race was on trial, as was Florida's Stand Your Ground law, except it wasn't, literally. Remember when police initially refused to arrest and charge George Zimmerman? That's because the Florida Stand Your Ground law, enacted in 2005, says police can't arrest someone who makes a claim that could be true that they were acting in self-defense. And George Zimmerman told police he was fighting off Trayvon Martin. But George Zimmerman's lawyers pointedly did not use the Stand Your Ground law in the actual trial. They went with self-defense. What's the difference? And if not in the actual trial, how did the Stand Your Ground law, which is now in 20 other states, affect this case? Doug Keene is a trial consultant in Austin, Texas. And Doug, anecdotally, people are shocked when we tell them this wasn't a Stand Your Ground defense. So remind us, what's the difference between Stand Your Ground and self-defense laws?
Stand Your Ground is different because you don't have to establish that you had no opportunity to escape the violence. That is, if you felt threatened, under the old law, you were obliged to try to escape the situation without use of deadly force. Under the new law, you don't have to establish that. If you feel a sense of threat and there's a felony going on, that is to say something like assault, then you have the opportunity to apply deadly force if you so choose.
Right. So under the Stand Your Ground laws, you can defend yourself even if you can get away, or even if your attacker is retreating, you can still defend yourself. So we're hearing the Zimmerman defense chose not to use the Stand Your Ground law because, first of all, the major portion of their case was that they wanted to show that George Zimmerman could not retreat, that he was pinned down by Trayvon Martin. So they didn't want that even raised. But also because if you're going to use the Stand Your Ground law as a defense, it requires a pre-trial hearing. And we are hearing now from the defense that they didn't want to give away their defense. So that's why they opted not to have that pre-trial hearing.
That makes good sense. It also puts something into the hands of the judge that they wanted in the hands of the jury. So we ended up having a situation where instead of having the judge determine whether or not he was under felony assault, the other requirements of the law were being met, instead they were able to present a more traditional kind of defense that didn't require the judge's ruling.
So instead of having the judge decide in a pretrial ruling what the attack was, they wanted to put that in the hands of the jury. And now when we come to the jury, we understand that when the jury received its instruction, even though the defense didn't choose a Stand Your Ground defense, the Stand Your Ground language was in the jury's instructions?
That's right. So even though it wasn't a point of defense that Mr. Zimmerman's team offered, it is in the standard instructions that the jury receives.
Is that new? Is that just, I mean, it would seem to be, just since the law was written in 2005?
Yes, that's right. These instructions are quite different. The previous instructions would have had the jury understand that if someone had the opportunity to retreat, then they were obliged to do it. And the problem in the Zimmerman case was that it was clear that the assault took place in an open ground, and it might have been difficult to establish that he had no opportunity to retreat without use of lethal force.
So in the new instructions, the jury was told that George Zimmerman had no duty to retreat.
That's exactly right. That's the phrase that is in the law as it currently exists.
How do you get to have the Stand Your Ground defense in the instructions to the jury, even if you don't go through the trouble and the pretrial hearing of choosing the Stand Your Ground defense?
Well, when laws like this are passed, it establishes standards for proof, and it also establishes the instructions that a jury is given. So the judge has no choice but to read the instructions as they exist in the law, and the jury is obliged to follow them as the law exists. So even though it's not something that is necessarily being argued by the defense, there's a great deal in the jury instructions that has nothing to do with whether or not that particular element of evidence is present in the case.
That's trial consultant Doug Keene. So Zimmerman's lawyers didn't use the Stand Your Ground law, but others are, including a white man who shot and killed a black man in Florida. The arresting deputy said the white man said all he did was shoot an N-word. That's why a lot of people think the Stand Your Ground law is racist, but a study from the Tampa Bay Times last year showed, if you look closely, it strips away that thinking. We'll link you at hereandnow.org. Meanwhile, what Doug thinks this case is about after the break.
Well, what do you think about this? We'd love to hear your thoughts at hereandnow.org. Are you protesting today? Do you accept the verdict in the Zimmerman trial? Let us know at hereandnow.org. We're back in a minute with more.
Funding for Here and Now comes from GEICO, protecting drivers and their families with insurance coverage for over 75 years. More at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO.
It's Here and Now, and we're speaking with jury consultant Doug Keene, who explained to us why the defense in the Zimmerman case did not use Florida's Stand Your Ground law, although the jury was asked to consider it. We also heard from the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who echoed protesters who say this was a trial about race. But Doug, you've said one of the legacies of this trial is guns. Why?
There's a good deal of research about guns and the cognitive shift that takes place in someone's mind when they actually have a gun in their hand. People feel differently when they are carrying a gun than they do otherwise, and they tend to engage in more risky behavior. They tend to feel safer from the standpoint that they will do things that might otherwise seem too dangerous. And they, in some ways, put themselves in harm's way or are willing to take risks that endanger themselves and thereby trigger the need to use the gun that they never would have done had they not had the gun on them. So I think there's a real troubling conflation of these carry laws that are becoming more liberalized in many parts of the country and the stand your ground type laws, which empower someone to use the gun whenever they have a sense of fear for their safety.
How do you see gun laws becoming, the carry laws becoming liberalized?
I happen to live in Texas, and one of the things that's happened over the last year is that carrying guns in public places is more and more common and more permitted under the law. You have college campuses being open to carrying guns. You have public parks and so forth. Places that didn't used to permit public display of weapons are now available for people to carry weapons and have them be publicly seen. And that is a big change. And one of the things that observers have expressed concern about is that when everyone assumes that everybody else has a gun, a criminal who might not otherwise escalate to use of a gun could conceivably make the point that, hey, I thought that there was risk that that person was going to assault me, and I felt justified in shooting him before I got shot.
So you're saying that criminals could make that claim?
Yes, and I haven't seen that happen yet, but I think it's inevitable that there are going to be shootouts in city streets based upon the assumption that he told me he was going to shoot me.
You say that the debate over guns used to be over the constitutional right to carry, and now it's shifting to a civil right. What do you mean by that?
People feel, you know, the arguments, if you track the debates in the various legislatures around the country that are looking at the gun laws, part of what you see is that there are increasing discussions not over the literal meaning of the Second Amendment, but over this much broader and more sweeping notion that I have a right to have a gun, therefore I have a right to have a gun everywhere, and no one has a right to tell me how to limit the availability of my gun or how I might defend myself. And that is a much different conversation than we've ever had in the history of the country. We have more guns per capita in the country now than we've ever had at any point in time, and we also have more people who feel strongly about the right to have availability of the weapon at all times and in all places.
Just for those who might have forgotten, characterize what the conversation about gun rights used to be.
Well, gun rights used to be really focused on the reasonable access to guns, not for personal self-defense, as if there's a war that's about to break out on the streets right in front of me, but rather people had legitimate reasons to have guns for hunting, for personal use of a more traditional nature. The perception that somehow we now need guns for personal safety as regular citizens, rather than somebody who's carrying valuables from point A to point B in the manner that you might have a security guard carry them, this is a completely new conversation that's only evolved over the last 20 years or so.
Well, but you say, I mean, we know it has shifted from hunting to non-hunters. But there was always an overriding sense that the constitutional right was that people could have a gun to defend themselves. And people interpreted the Second Amendment as meaning potentially defend themselves against their own government.
That was always in the fine print of the conversation, but it was never a headline in the conversation. And that's part of the change that's taken place. People feel as if the government itself has become an adversary worthy of justifying a defense, which doesn't make a lot of sense on a lot of different levels, but that is certainly a part of the very earnestly and fervently believed argument advanced by the Second Amendment advocates.
So, Doug Keene, while we have you, you are a trial consultant. You assist people in trial strategy, how to choose juries, how to prepare witnesses for trial. So your thoughts on this trial in particular and the prosecution in particular?
Well, I think that the prosecution had a difficult challenge in front of them due to the standards that are currently in place in the law. The defense merely had to establish that there was a perception of risk of bodily harm on the part of Mr. Zimmerman for these instructions to be resonant with jurors. As long as the jurors were willing to accept that this law is legitimate and that they were willing to follow the law as written, the notion that Mr. Zimmerman had the right to use deadly force because he was in fear for himself and that there was a felony going on, the perception that Mr. Martin was being aggressive toward him in a manner that caused him fear, was almost the end of the trial.
It doesn't matter. I mean, because some people have asked, where was Trayvon Martin's right to stand his ground? It doesn't matter that Trayvon Martin might only have been in a tussle with George Zimmerman because Trayvon Martin thought that he was being stalked?
According to the jury instructions, if Mr. Zimmerman was involved in some sort of an altercation that did not involve a felony, it's possible the jury could have determined that the use of excessive force was not justified. So if Mr. Martin's tussle, if you will, with Mr. Zimmerman was all about Mr. Zimmerman having provoked a fight, then Mr. Martin's defense of himself isn't a felony. Well, all of that got quite blurry in the testimony, and I think what the jury obviously came away with was a sense that Mr. Zimmerman was genuinely fearful for his own health and safety. Based upon that, Mr. Martin, without a voice in the courtroom, the prosecution was going to have a difficult time establishing anything but Mr. Zimmerman's fearfulness.
Well, you say he didn't have a voice in the courtroom. Of course, he wasn't there, but your thoughts on the voices that were there? We've heard a lot of comments that the witnesses were not prepared, that the young girl who was his friend, who was on the phone with him, was not prepared by the prosecutors. Your sense of how well the prosecution did?
I'm not prepared to pass judgment on the attorney performance on either side of the case, frankly. I think that is a very difficult thing to do without being physically present in the courtroom. One thing I will say about Rachel Gentile, the young woman who testified as having listened to the phone call, there's been a lot of criticism of the prosecution for not having prepared her, but if the prosecution had spent a significant amount of time helping her become a more effective witness, that would have been discoverable by the defense, and it would have been something that the defense could have picked apart and actually reduced her credibility and reduced her effectiveness as a witness rather than enhance it, because it suddenly she would become not only a witness called by the prosecution, but a witness that has actually been schooled by the prosecution. And that does not go over well with jurors.
Huh. Fascinating. Doug Keene of Keene Trial Consulting, thanks so much. So, Jeremy, as expected, intense debate on Facebook and at HereNow.org.
Yeah, one listener writes, I think there's evidence to support a civil suit for wrongful death, as in O.J. Simpson's case, but a civil rights suit, a federal civil rights suit, seems like a waste of time and money. And on our conversation with Jesse Jackson, who told us he does not accept the verdict, Fisher writes, stop instigating. Whether you accept the verdict or not, it stands. The law has prevailed.
Let us hear from you. Meanwhile, latest news is next. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from Lumosity.com. With web-based brain games created by neuroscientists to improve memory and attention. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And Diedrichs, with outdoor furniture, dinnerware, and home accessories selected for form, function, and feeling for your home. DIDRIKS.com.